And hello again, this is Ms. G, and I am bringing you Left Hanging here tonight at 104.3. And I am reading from the book Faith, Hope, and Hilarity. And there are stories compiled by Ann Spangler and Cherry McDonald. And I'd like to start off with G. Ron Darby's story, One Man's Treasure. I suppose I should have seen it coming, should have recognized the signs, picked up on the subtle hint. But after so many years of marriage, I really didn't want to believe it was true. Oh, she sent all the right signals, I guess. She even threatened a time or two. Maybe I loved her too much, trusted her too completely. When it finally happened, when all that trust shattered and her veil of secrecy lifted, there was no one left to blame but myself. I went to bed early, consistent with my usual routine. Rather than falling directly to sleep, I waited. Because of my morning commute, it was not unusual for me to retire before Sue. Anyway, I didn't think she knew of my suspicions, but later she claimed she did. In a way, I think she wanted to be caught, to get it out in the open and end the sneaking around. About an hour later, Sue poked her head in the door, ensuring herself I was out for the night. I heard the fumbling of keys in her purse and the sound of the back door creaking before I rose and followed in pursuit. Stepping into the garage behind her, I caught her red-handed. "Ah," I said in the manner of one who has just caught his spouse red-handed. "So what do you have to say for yourself?" Sue spun around quickly, startled and caught off guard. Following her first impulse, she feigned surprise and pretended to gasp for breath, all the while attempting to hide something in the small of her back. I didn't fall for the clever ruse and demanded to see what she held behind her. "It's nothing," Sue said. "Really, nothing." Her face displayed only guilt, and shame shone through the facade of shock. "Nothing is it," I said. "We'll see about that. What have you got there? What are you hiding behind your back?" "Don't make me show you," she pleaded. "Please, can we just go inside and forget about this, pretend it never happened?" "I don't think so, Sue. It's gone too far. I'll be seeing what you're hiding there now, if you please." Slowly, cautiously, she pulled her hand around. I knew what to expect even before I saw it. "Those are my baseball cards, aren't they?" I said, my heart nearly pounding through my chest. "You've been cleaning out the garage again, haven't you?" "Yes," she said defiantly, holding her head up high, ready to stand her ground. She had done it, yes, and she was glad. "And you've been rummaging through my things," I asked. "I suppose you've thrown away some of my stuff." "Yes," she answered, "and I'll do it again if I had the chance. It's all junk. Somebody had to clear it out of here." So there it was, a turning point, a roadblock in our marriage. We could take the easy way, like so many other couples we knew, or we could try to work it out. Our life together was too important to both of us. We had made a commitment, a lifelong commitment. "We could work this out, sweetheart," I said, in the spirit of reconciliation. "Let me see it all. We'll do this thing together." That was one of the most difficult things I've ever done. Sue, like many women, doesn't know the first thing about memorabilia. She sees a box of baseball cards, an old ball glove, and immediately heads toward the trash pile. And the whole time our house is cluttered with real junk. Photographs, old letters, and hand-me-downs disguised as family heirlooms. "Show me what you've thrown away so far," I said, wanting to minimize the losses. She pointed toward a trash can nearly overflowing with my possessions. "Not my first ball glove," I yelled as I extracted the crown of my earthly treasures. "You couldn't have meant to throw away my baseball mitt." "It doesn't even fit you anymore," Sue said. "You couldn't possibly get your hand in there." "But it has Juan Sabota's signature on the thumb, Sue. How could you do this?" "I don't see a signature on it," she said, squinting in the poor light of our garage. "Well, it used to be on there," I said. "You can sort of make it out if you know what to look for." I continued rummaging through the pile. "Now wait just a minute. Do you know what this is?" I asked. "Do you know what you've thrown away?" "Old baseball cards," Sue said. Accurate guess, but she obviously didn't get the whole picture. "Not just old baseball cards, Sue. This is Mickey Mantle, Mick the Stick, one of the greatest baseball players of all time. Do you know how much this is worth?" "I'll tell you, several hundred dollars." "I apologize," Sue said. "I never would have thrown it away if I had known how much it was worth. Can we sell it?" "Sell it? This is my youth we're talking about, Sue. How much is my youth worth to you?" "How much can we get?" she asked. Determining that we were getting nowhere following that course, I switched gears slightly and attempted to gain the upper hand. "How much of your junk have you thrown away, sweetheart?" I asked. "Over there by the shelves," she pointed in the direction of the washing machine. "A toilet brush that's seen better days, some slippers, and that cookbook your mother gave me." I couldn't believe my ears. "The cookbook my mother wrote with her own two hands?" I asked. "You threw away Mom's Chronology of Darby Cuisine? How could you?" "It's not even a real cookbook, just a list of ingredients," Sue argued. "She didn't write down any amounts. What am I supposed to do? Guess?" "Okay, fine," I said. "Why are we saving this, then?" I picked up an old encyclopedia volume and thrust it in Sue's direction. "Open the book, Sue, and you know what you'll find? Dead flowers. Might I ask why we are saving dead flowers?" "Those happen to be the first flowers you sent me," Sue said, as though that revelation was supposed to make a difference. "They're still dead, Sue," I said. "And quite frankly, I don't understand." "Mickey, you toss away without a second thought, and a dozen carnations get immortalized between the pages of World Book." "Roses," she corrected. "They were roses, and I thought it was better to save them than expect new ones on occasion." Immediately recognizing that this, too, was not a course I wanted to take, I changed directions one last time. "Sounds like we compromise," I said. "I tell you what, I don't mind if you keep the dried flowers. How's that?" "Fine," she said, "and you can keep Sticky Mickey if it means that much to you." "Mick the stick, honey," I corrected. "Yes, it means that much to me. Why don't we try to get through the rest of this stuff tomorrow after we've both gotten some sleep, and we'll get a fresh start." "Okay, and I'm sorry I tossed your things without first considering your feelings." We headed for the bedroom hand in hand, the disagreement now behind us, when Sue asked another question. "By the way," she said, "what was the tooth you saved in the baby food jar?" "Tell me you didn't throw away the tooth," I said. "That wasn't just any tooth, Sue. That tooth belonged to Dave Schultz, hatchet man for the Philadelphia Flyers back in the 70s. I picked it up off the ice after an Islanders game. At least I think it belonged to Schultz. Hockey players lose a lot of teeth, and it's not always easy keeping track and watching the puck, too." "You took the man's tooth?" she asked in a voice that suggested disbelief. "Didn't you offer to give it back to him at least?" "Nah," I said. "Those guys drop their teeth all the time. They're like souvenirs. If they really cared about their dental work, they wouldn't be playing ice hockey now, would they?" "I guess not. But I still think you should have at least offered," she said. "And by the way, the tooth goes." "Let's talk about it in the morning, sweetheart." "The tooth goes." "Good night, Sue," I said. "Good night." As we drifted off to sleep, I thought about how some people can't seem to appreciate the finer, more sentimental things in life. And for all this time, I had lived under the impression that women were the more emotional partners. It's just lucky she didn't find my collection of athletic footwear. I'm sure she would have burned them. You've been listening to me read G. Ron Darby's One Man's Treasure out of Faith, Hope, and Hilarity. I'll be right back with another story at Left Hanging here with Ms. G at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And hello, this is Ms. G, and I'm back with Left Hanging here at 104.3. And my next story is titled Chatting with Martha Stewart About My To-Do List by Chanda Pierce. Last night, I had another dream about Martha Stewart. She showed up at my house early in the morning, just after the kids had gone to school. We sat in my huge sunroom, which I don't have in real life, that's how I knew it was a dream, and talked like old girlfriends, while a small jazz ensemble played in the far corner by the fountain that had real koi fish swimming about and several thousand dollars in change underwater where people had stopped to make a wish. Martha and I were sipping our coffee, just some cheap decaffeinated stuff I had bought at Kroger's. "So your kids are in school?" she asked. "Oh, yes, long ago," I answer. "Children are so cute," she said, sipping her coffee. "I would love to have watched them make their own breakfasts and prepare their own lunches to take." "Me too." "You mean you didn't watch them?" "I mean they didn't make their own breakfasts, let alone their own lunches." She set down her coffee cup slowly and said, "You mean you prepared for both of them? And myself and my husband." "Oh my," her forehead wrinkled. "Oh, Martha, enough about that. I've been dying to ask you something. On that show you did last Christmas, did you really make your own salt and pepper?" Martha cut a glance about the room to make sure we were alone, with the exception of the jazz ensemble and the fish, of course. Then she confided. "I have to be honest." I leaned in closer. "Someone else quarried the salt."
"No."
She nodded. "Of course, I grew and harvested the pepper and ground it myself. And I filled the shakers." She smiled and seemed pleased with herself. She nodded her approval to the jazz ensemble and then looked around the room. "This is such a lovely room. Did you make it?" "Oh, heavens no, are you kidding? I just dreamed this thing up. I have so much laundry to do. When would I find time to make glass and glue it together like you would?" "Laundry? What do you mean by laundry?" "You know, separating the darks from the whites, the towels from the delicates." "Then what?" "Then I put them in the washer, add soap." "I can make soap." "Make sure all the socks are turned right side out." "All of them?" I nodded. "And then dry, and fold, and put away." "Where?" "Why, into the proper chest of drawers or closet, or at least in neat little stacks in the corner of the room." I hadn't thought about that. "So how long does a job like that last?" she wanted to know. I paused for a long moment, for effect, I admit, and to give her an opportunity to swallow her last drink of coffee before saying deliberately, "Forever." She put a hand to her mouth, and I feared maybe I hadn't paused long enough. "I hadn't thought about that," she said. "Oh, please," I said, "enough about laundry. Do tell me about that crumpet party I saw on your show once." "Crumpets are boring," she said. "Then tell me about how you made your own paper for the invitations." She dismissed this with a wave and said, "Just like any other paper, wood, pulp, etc." Then, lowering her cup from a fresh swallow, she asked, "Have you ever vacuumed your carpet?" I nodded. "I mean, like a whole room?" "Try a whole house," I said, trying not to sound as though I were bragging. She gasped. "And then I usually dust," I added. "Dust what?" "The furniture." "I can build furniture," she said. "I know, Martha, and you're quite good." Just then the phone rang and I answered, "Oh, yes, I'm expecting you. I'll be here with Martha Stewart." "Okay, I'll ask." I covered the phone and asked Martha, "The plumber wants to know why the hot water valve is always on the left and cold on the right." "Tell him," Martha said, "to watch this Sunday's program." "Watch her this Sunday," I said into the phone. "Besides, this is my dream and I'm having my own chat." I hung up and said, "That was the plumber. He'll be here in a bit." "Plumber? For what?" "The toilet's stopped up." She set down her coffee and pushed it away. "How do you do it?" "Do what?" "Take care of your children and your husband, do the laundry, vacuum, dust the furniture, take out the trash." "You do take out your own trash." "Only when it's full." "And then cook." I nodded, but I had never thought of my day as quite so overwhelming, so daunting a task, until I heard Martha Stewart lay it out so plainly. I shrugged and said, "Practice, I guess." The plumber showed up, gave Martha a big hug, and told her how great her spinach quiche recipe was. He dragged out a big coiled cable with a giant electric motor that uncoiled the cable across the room and into my toilet. After a few moments, the plumber spun it backwards and pulled out Bongo, my son's favorite Beanie Baby. So that's where they went, I said, spraying it down with some shouting, dropping it into the washer, which was set for the very next load. Zach would be excited when he got back from school. The plumber asked for Martha's autograph on an old, nasty plunger of all things, picked up his auger, and left. I retrieved a mop from the garage and wiped up some size 13 prints from the vinyl floor. Why do you do this? Martha asked, exasperation evident in her voice. Do what? All this. And she waved an arm about my big sunroom, but she meant my whole house. The laundry, the dusting, the vacuuming, the mopping. Don't forget the windows. You do windows? Why? Couldn't you just hire someone to take care of menial tasks like these so you would have more time for other things, like weaving napkins with an interlaced monogram or crafting reproductions of early American Shaker furniture? Now that the plumbing seemed to be taken care of, I filled Martha's cup with more coffee. The dark liquid warmed the cup. Sunshine poured through the glass overhead and warmed everything else. I noticed the streaks in the dust, so I added clean the sunroom to my to-do list. I'd take care of it as soon as Martha left. I carried the pot of coffee back to the kitchen and dragged the mop behind me, thinking about Martha's question. The jazz ensemble was playing something perky now as I answered her. Perhaps in your dreams, things like that can happen, Martha, but not in mine. Glancing at my watch, my heart thumped. Any minute, my kids would be barreling in the door looking for an after-school snack. I pulled a box of Little Debbie snack cakes out of the cupboard and laid them on a plastic plate. No, I didn't make them myself, but the kids won't care. They'll be too busy ripping open the wrappers, and I'll be too busy hearing about their day. I'm pretty comfortable with that. Suddenly, I felt a little sad for Martha. On the way past the fountain, I flipped in a quarter and made a wish. You've just heard me read you Chatting with Martha Stewart About My To-Do List by Chanda Pierce. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Left Hanging tonight, and I'll be right back here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Stay tuned. Ms. G. I am bringing you Left Hanging here tonight. And hope you enjoyed the last two stories. I have one quick one for you, and it will be done for the evening. This is Gourmet Napping by Becky Freeman. I used to think I didn't have much time for such luxuries. A nap? Are you kidding? In the middle of my hectic day? Please. Or I might take one, but wake up feeling frazzled and guilty. There was always this fast-forward tape going on in my head, taunting me with a sing-song, "You're getting behind her, you're getting behind her." I thought if I just kept doing and doing, staying focused on my to-do list, no matter what or who interrupted my day, I could actually eventually catch up. Then one bright morning, I had this incredible moment of enlightenment and realized the truth. There is no such place as all caught up. It only exists out there in our imaginations, along with Oz and Santa's Workshop and Never Never Land. Why didn't the grown-ups tell us this when we were kids? I don't know. I simply don't know. Perhaps they, too, are still struggling under the illusion that it exists somewhere out there. You may have to grieve a little over the loss of this fairy tale ketchup land. You'll find it a healthy cleansing experience, though, because in the long run, I guarantee you'll be thankful I told you the hard truth right now before you waste any more time chasing a dream. When you give up on the existence of all caught up, you are free to do all those wonderful things you were waiting to do until you arrive there. Like, for example, taking a guilt-free nap. I have learned the hard way that taking a short nap is the best thing I can do when I'm plagued with hurry-uppities. I used to cram, pray, recite, and practice before a speech. Now I look for a good place to snooze for 20 minutes instead. I'm convinced that God goes inside our brains and cleans house in there when we resign control of the universe long enough to let go and drift into a short sleep. I've actually elevated napping to a gourmet experience. Let's say it's a springtime afternoon loaded with deadlines, housework, phone calls, and 100 obligations, and I begin to feel the pressure building inside. I love the title of Julie Barnhill's new book, She's Gonna Blow. Any woman who's been there knows what built-up tension feels like and how everyone around you can pick it up. Like a movie producer who yells, "Cut," I've learned to stop, walk away from the middle of the action, and melt like a boneless chicken into my quilt-laden hammock. I soak up the warmth of sunshine on my skin and watch the play of light on the leaves and the trees overhead. Then I imagine my brain is a lot like the world before God fixed it up. Dark, formless, and void. Very void. And I pray, "Oh, hover over me the way you hovered over the formless deep and create order out of the chaos that is now my mind." As I imagine myself cocooned in his spirit, I almost always fall into a deep, peaceful sleep. Then I wake up in a few minutes, refreshed without a trace of guilt. Can you believe it? Trust me, this sort of experience has been a long time in coming. Now there are books on power napping, and a number of corporations are even beginning to create napping rooms, realizing that the long-lasting effects of 15 minutes of rest are more effective than caffeine infusions from the coffee station. How can I stop for a nap when I have so much I should be doing, you may ask? Here is the answer. You get three times as much accomplished in one well-rested hour as you do in 3 hours of plodding along half awake. Take an hour to sleep and an hour to work, and you gain a whole extra hour to play with. Okay, I'll admit I just made that up. But you're just going to have to trust me on this one. For you more scientific types, I do have some objective research proving that one nap a day will increase the number of your highly creative periods. It has to do with hypnopomping and hypnagoguing. Really? I'm not making this up. Hypnopomping actually refers to that period of time just before we are completely awake, when our mental pictures are a mixture of dreams and our own created images. It is considered one of the most productively creative periods. Hypnagoguing, on the other hand, is that time just before we are asleep. Again, it is when images are a mixture of dreams and thoughts under our control, another highly creative state of mind. Thomas Edison had an unusual technique for putting that hypnagogic state to work. He would doze off in a chair with his arms and hands draped over the armrest. In each hand, he held a ball bearing, and below each hand on the floor were two pie plates. When he drifted into the state between waking and sleeping, his hands would naturally relax and the ball bearings would drop on the plates. Awakened by the noise, Edison would immediately make notes on any ideas that had come to him. I wish someone would explain why, if we are such a brilliantly advanced nation, American forefathers let the concept of a nationwide nap slip through the cracks of the Constitution. I appreciate that Ronald Reagan took naps while he was president. I, for one, miss having him in the Oval Office, relaxed enough to take a little snooze now and then. His mere napping presence was soothing. After all, if the president could nod off, what was there for the rest of us to worry about? In Latin America, they deal with mid-afternoon slumps by embracing the siesta. The English have a country-wide sleepy time breather they disguise as a tea party. Again, it takes place in the late afternoon, and because the English are the way they are, they call it high tea. One of England's most celebrated citizens, William Shakespeare, penned the poignant words, "O sleep, O gentle sleep, beloved nap time, nature's soft nurse." Indeed, a short sleep is a healing balm. Now, if you'll excuse me, the birds are tweeting outside my office window, the quilt-covered hammock is calling, and so off to hypnagogue I go. You've just heard me read Becky Freeman's Gourmet Napping from Faith, Hope, and Hilarity. This has been Left Hanging with Ms. G. Until next time, good night.